Lovecraft's productivity as an amateur journalist was astonishing. It put him at the hub of a network of outsiders with whom he communicated, usually by post, and at length. After his mother's nervous breakdown and her eventual death from a botched gallbladder operation, such networks provided a lifeline and a legitimation for the formerly reclusive Lovecraft. In his mid-30s, the confirmed bachelor astonished everyone by getting married to another amateur journalist, Sonia Haft-Green, a widowed Russian Jew 7 years his senior. He moved to her apartment in Brooklyn, where, as manager of a successful hat shop on Fifth Avenue, she was able to pay the bills while he eked out a bare living selling stories to the pulps and ghostwriting for clients who included the escapologist Harry Houdini. Ever in search of what he called adventures in antiquity, Lovecraft was married in St. Paul's Chapel in Lower Manhattan. In so doing, he had chosen the oldest extant colonial building to remain in New York City. In the chapel, whose graveyard now leads directly and poignantly down to Ground Zero, I met the critic and horror writer, Peter Cannon.
His letters from this period are filled with descriptions of tours of Manhattan and Brooklyn and cities in New Jersey and out in Long Island that had remains of the 18th century. America, much as it is a new country, there were still in New York City a few survivals of that older time that he looked back to with such nostalgia and fondness. And St. Paul's Chapel, which I believe was built in the late 18th century, George Washington worshipped there, was just such a vestige of this old aristocratic English way of life that he so admired and tried to emulate in his own life as a gentleman.
And so the chapel may have been one of the few positive ways in which he could have a good New York, he could connect with the city.
Even though he was a materialist, he believed very much in tradition, and getting married in the Episcopal Church suited him. Right after they were married, they went off on their honeymoon to Philadelphia and spent most of the honeymoon trying to resurrect a manuscript of a story that Lovecraft had lost in the train station. And as his wife Sonia said, during the honeymoon, with all that work on the manuscript, they had very little time to honeymoon.
Lovecraft's foreshortened honeymoon did not augur well for his marriage. But this had hardly been a courtship along the usual lines. Sonia would later state, loyally, that Howard had been an adequately excellent lover, but she was invariably the one to initiate sexual contact. After their first kiss, he actually blushed and admitted that this was his first kiss since childhood. And in a memoir written years later, Sonia wrote that he was never able to say the word love to her. When Sonia left her job to start her own business, Lovecraft's childhood experience of a fall from gentility to poverty seemed doomed to repeat itself. Lovecraft sought relief from the pressures of both marriage and job-seeking with the writers, all male, who became known as the Kalem Club, named after their initials. He would sometimes spend all night leading them in nocturnal rambles, hunting out the increasingly rare antique buildings and hidden courtyards of modern New York.
This is the Dutch Reformed Church in Flatbush in Brooklyn. It's only a few blocks from where his future wife...
The Lovecraft scholar and publisher, Derek Hussey.
And in 1922, Lovecraft came to this church with his friend Reinhard Kleiner. And exploring in this old graveyard in back, Lovecraft was moved to chip away a piece of a tombstone here. And a week later, he wrote to his Aunt Lillian, "From one of the crumbling gravestones, dated 1747, I chipped away a small piece to carry away. It lies before me as I write and ought to suggest some sort of a horror story. I must some night place it beneath my pillow as I sleep. Who can say what thing might not come out of the censured earth to exact vengeance for his desecrated tomb?"
And what was the story that Lovecraft wrote about this experience?
In fact, the story is called The Hound, and it details the exploits of a man and his friend St. John, who was obviously intended to be Kleiner, who come to this graveyard and do, in fact, exhume a coffin from which they remove an amulet. And the occupant of the grave hunts them down, kills St. John, and retrieves his amulet, and the Lovecraftian narrator comes back to the graveyard and digs again and finds the renovant back in his grave, covered in the blood of his friend and bearing the amulet which he had retrieved. Madness closes in.
I can recall the scene in these final moments. The pale autumnal moon over the graves, casting long, horrible shadows. The grotesque trees, drooping sullenly to meet the neglected grass and the crumbling slabs. The vast legions of strangely colossal bats that flew against the moon. The antique ivied church, pointing a huge spectral finger at the livid sky. The phosphorescent insects that danced like death fires under the yews in a distant corner. The odors of mold, vegetation, and less explicable things that mingled feebly with the night wind from over the far swamps and seas. And worst of all, the faint, deep-toned baying of some gigantic hound, which we could neither see nor definitely place.
We've just walked from the apartment block in Parkside in the Flatbush area of Brooklyn, where Lovecraft lived with his wife Sonia for around 9 months in 1924. However, circumstances led Lovecraft to a move to 169 Clinton Street, a much less salubrious area. A house of early Victorian date with white classic woodwork and tall windows with paneled seats. So Lovecraft wrote in his diary for 1925.
His fortunes were continually decreasing. He was unable to find steady work as a writer or even as a ghostwriter or revisionist. And at the end of 1924, he and his wife made the decision to part company, temporarily at least, Sonia out to Cincinnati, Ohio, and Lovecraft to more modest surroundings here on Clinton Street, where the rent was $40 a month. This neighborhood was going downhill. He was unaware that there were a lot of immigrants and Syrians and different types of nationalities living around here, which he really was not too keen on.
Red Hook is a maze of hybrid squalor near the ancient waterfront opposite Governor's Island. The population is a hopeless tangle and enigma. Syrian, Spanish, Italian, and Negro elements impinging on one another, and fragments of Scandinavian and American belts lying not far distant. It is a babble of sound and filth, and sends out strange cries to answer the lapping of oily waves at its grimy piers and the monstrous organ litanies of the harbor whistles. Here, long ago, a brighter picture dwelt, with clear-eyed mariners on the lower streets and homes of taste and substance where the larger houses line the hill. From this tangle of material and spiritual putrescence, the blasphemies of 100 dialects assail the sky.
In the story, there's a lot of emphasis on underground wharves, on secret ways of getting into the country. And so the divisions between land and water are somehow blurred or cosmically messed up. All kinds of horrible creatures seem to be making their way in.
Yes, I think you could almost view it as a sort of a reverse Ellis Island, where Ellis Island is often seen as a shining beacon. Come one, come all, you're tired, you're huddled masses. That was appalling to Lovecraft. He didn't want any more tired and huddled masses. They were all around him. You know, he would like to send them all back out.
The letters home to his Aunt Lillian are even more virulent and offensive than the bile lurking in stories like The Horror at Red Hook and He. Though he married a Jew, Lovecraft could only tolerate the ethnically other when diluted by assimilation, and advised Sonia of his preference for an Aryan majority in situations involving mixed company. Difference, so prized in the culture of today, was not something he valued. Indeed, his literary monsters and nightmares articulate the deepest abhorrence of it.
I think their predominant color was grayish-green, though they had white bellies. They were mostly shiny and slippery, but the ridges of their backs were scaly.
I look at the shadow over Innsmouth, in which these dreadful creatures from the sea, fish frogs as he calls them, end up mating with the local townspeople of a small New England town called Innsmouth, and producing even worse hybrids.
Their forms vaguely suggested the anthropoid, while their heads were the heads of fish, with prodigious bulging eyes that never closed. At the sides of their necks were palpitating gills, and their long paws were webbed. I was somehow glad that they had no more than four limbs. Their croaking, baying voices, clearly used for articulate speech, held all the dark shades of expression which their staring faces lacked.
it's hard to see this as anything other than Lovecraft's warning of miscegenation, of the mixing of races.
Given all this, how far did his vocation as a horror writer allow him to transmute repulsion into something powerful and engaging?
When you look at the things underneath the typical Lovecraft story, they're actually pretty disturbing.
Kelly Link.
There's a lot of negative feeling towards foreigners, strangers, with a lot of horror. When you look at the stuff underneath it, it's actually quite unpleasant, and it stems from a lot of different kinds of prejudice. And that's useful stuff to mine for horror, but I think some of the reasons why horror is appealing to people are not particularly settling reasons when you think about them. Even horror today, when I write stuff which sticks closer to traditional horror, if I look at the stuff underneath it, it's not terribly pleasant.
The marriage to Sonia inevitably ended. Lovecraft was desperate to get back to Providence, or at least to its atmosphere and architecture, not its population. As a letter to Aunt Lillian begging her to let him come home gives evidence, Lovecraft's alienated imagination worked like a neutron bomb, saving buildings but removing people.
It may be taken as axiomatic that the people of a place matter absolutely nothing to me, except as components of a general landscape and scenery. My life lies not among people, but among scenes. My local affections are not personal, but topographical and architectural. I am always an outsider, but outsiders have their sentimental preferences for visual environment. I will be dogmatic only to the extent of saying that it is New England I must have, in some form or other. Providence is part of me. I am Providence.
The key tales that go to make up what would in time be known by devotees and younger writers as the Cthulhu mythos were written following his return to Providence in the summer of 1926. Living with his aunts, first Lillian, then later Annie, Lovecraft was in the most creative period of his life.
So now we've reached the holy grail of Lovecraft's career in the pulps. This is an issue of Weird Tales, subtitled The Unique Magazine, February 1928, and it contains the first printing of one of his most famous stories, The Call of Cthulhu. But that's not the story which is illustrated on the cover.
That's true. Unfortunately, none of Lovecraft's contributions to Weird Tales included a cover illustration of his work. His name does appear at the bottom, saying that a Lovecraft contribution is there, but for some reason he never made it onto the cover.
It's very symptomatic that that story was rejected when it was first submitted to Weird Tales. I think the editor, Farnsworth Rice, simply couldn't understand it. It was too advanced, too unusual, and so Lovecraft, about a year later, had to resubmit the story and accompanied it with a letter, one of the most fascinating letters he ever wrote, explaining what he was trying to do, emphasizing the fact that this story really incorporates his cosmic philosophy more concentratedly than anything he had done before.
So what's really new about this story?
Well, let us remember that Lovecraft was an atheist. He grew up as a Baptist, but by the age of 12, he declared himself a complete atheist. And so now, how does an atheist write stories about gods from outer space? Well, it becomes clear that these are not really gods. They are simply extraterrestrials who have come from the depths of space and by a series of accidents wound up in the human sphere. And they are regarded as gods and worshipped as gods by the human beings who hope to benefit from their eventual takeover of the Earth. But quite frankly, these entities have as little concern with human beings as we would for a colony of ants. And so this cosmic vision is something really new to literature.